A little bit of the theme that we had for this conference is talking about Internet of Things. And so these are some ideas that I've had kicking around in my mind for many, many years. And I've got a half hour to relay years of deep thinking. So we'll see how it goes. I haven't keynoted ELC for many years. I think the last time I did the keynote for ELC was in 2005. So the industry has changed since then. Conservative estimates are that Linux is running in about 1.5 billion devices worldwide, somewhere between 1.5 billion and 2 billion. That's B, you know, billion with a B. I'm going to talk about how we can get to that next 9 billion, or at least some of my thoughts about how to get to that next 9 billion, but I don't have a specific action. I don't have a call to action. A couple of years ago in the U.S., there was a movie that came out that caught my attention. I thought it was totally awesome. Kind of bent your mind in some interesting ways. And so what I really want to do is, well, in this movie, an international team implants ideas into their subjects' minds so they can do some kind of industrial heist. I want to inject some ideas into your mind. I don't care if you know that I'm trying to do it because there's nothing, there's no espionage involved here. I don't have any dream invading equipment with me, so I'm just going to try to do it with some slides. So my outline is I'm going to talk about open source and network effects, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about how that intersects with embedded, that the Internet of Things, I can tell you're starting to go to sleep already, so my plan is working. So let's go look at the big picture. So open source, let's start with open source. Very fundamentally, the very first definition, open source software can be freely used and changed and shared by anyone. And that is really, really powerful. It's the reason we're all here. If you look at what guarantees that freedom, it's the GPL license. Okay? That puts in place a legal framework for how the sharing is required to occur legally. And there are other licenses that also have kind of different legal terms, so people can balance kind of the rights and responsibilities of the developers versus the end users. And some of these licenses talk about patents and intellectual property and things like that. But if you look at open source in general, how it works, the core idea is that developers publish their derivative software. But you can't just take your derivative works and put them in a tarball and stick them on an FTP server. That's not how open source really functions if it's gonna develop. You have to do more than just publish. You actually have to contribute. And contribution means something different. It means that what we do is we build a community. And so we have lots of ways that we get together as a community. We talk to each other on mailing lists. We come to these conferences and share ideas. And what we do is we start building up a set of resources, a set of technologies that we share in order to accomplish something with the software. And one of the things I really want to talk about and drill down in this presentation is about network effects. I think a lot of us just don't understand how deep, how important network effects. We have an intuitive feel, but I want to talk a lot about them in general. So what is a network effect? So a lot of us are engineers. We think network, we're thinking TCP/IP or IPX or the phone network. And the very first example of a network effect that is always given, and I will be no exception, is the phone network. So what happens is that every node that gets added to the phone network in some infinitesimal way actually adds to the value of all of the phones already on the network. Okay? And that is a really interesting effect. There are multiple different types of networks. I talked about the phone network. If you think about it, even some person who turns on a phone, a new subscriber in Africa or in Asia, okay, you might not want to call them today. In fact, you might not want them to call you. But every single phone that turns on increases the opportunities, increases the capabilities of the network, and increases the value for you. And this is a kind of a traditional classic network effect where the value of the system increases every time you add to it. There are other types of network effects, though. So the phone network is an example of what's termed a one-sided network effect. There are two-sided network effects or multi-sided network effects, and we're all very familiar with this. Intuitively, we totally understand the desktop wars that occurred in the 90s between Microsoft and Apple and Linux. So Microsoft basically won that battle. We won't go into the year of the Linux desktop or any of that stuff, but if you look at it, what happened was Microsoft was able to tip the scales in their advantage because they had the most users. And because they had the most users, they had the most app developers. Because they had the most app developers, they had the most users again. So it was a virtuous cycle for them. And we see the exact same thing that has played out just in the last few years between Android and iOS. So you see, in fact, the tech magazines were just chock full of discussions about who had more apps. Okay, how many apps were in the App Store? That was the huge thing when Android came out. And so this notion, you know, people didn't think about it in kind of rigorous mathematical terms, but everybody understood that how many apps really affected the value of the system, the perceived value to the end users, and this cycle that you could get going to tip the scales. Another area where you see network effects, or where we have historically seen network effects, is in format wars. And these are bloody battles between technologists and content providers. And the biggest one that people, well, you have to go kind of way back, is VHS versus Betamax. And people talked about the technical merits of that. Almost inconsequential, the technical merits. It all became about who could tip the scales one way or the other. And VHS won that battle. Another huge one that occurred was HD DVD and Blu-ray, and that's been a lot more recent. I was following this very, very, very closely. I was at Sony, so I was kind of interested to see what happened, whether Blu-ray or HD DVD would win. And I was absolutely shocked. I thought that this was a battle that would go on for years because it looked like the sides were so evenly matched up. And what happened just totally surprised me. Within a period of about 3 weeks, one of the content providers, Warner Brothers, switched over onto Blu-ray, and it just tipped the scales enough. And seriously, the battle was over in like 3 weeks. Toshiba had admitted the defeat, and it was like, wow, these things can happen really fast. And network effects are super, super important. And what you see developing is this theory of how two-sided markets work. I think it's incredibly fascinating that even here in the year 2014, there are still academic papers being published on theories about how multi-sided markets work. And about, you know, if you have, you know, YouTube is a kind of a three-sided market because you have advertisers, you have content producers, you have content consumers. TV is another market that's kind of at least two-sided, maybe three- or four-sided. And you have these theories about, well, what do you do? How do you treat the cost-sensitive side of the market versus the non-cost-sensitive side? And this is an area of active research. And it's kind of exciting to see that there's still this type of stuff going on. One of the things I really want to hammer is that network effects are everywhere. All of the large companies understand and are trying to leverage network effects. So if you look at Google, and this is something I've always been fascinated by, how Google became such a dominant player and what was their key insight. Well, one of them, I mean, they had a great search engine, but in the early days of the internet, it really was a battle between Google and Yahoo. And the Yahoo model was to build a hierarchical, basically set of bookmarks that you could use to find the content. And they had hundreds of engineers or content analyzers, people who went and looked and organized the content into these hierarchies, and Google did pure search. And the interesting thing is that Google kind of foresaw that the internet was going to get so big that this hierarchical model was not going to scale. And what happened is every person who brought a new website online in the 90s, when this battle was raging, was really, in a very small incremental way, making Yahoo's model less scalable or have less value and Google's value have more model. That's the power of network effects. Now, as individual site coming online, that's like inconsequential, but it's the accumulation of those effects that is just amazing. You have third parties, people completely unrelated to Google, bringing a site online, and that actually increases Google's competitive edge. So market effects, that's what companies are trying to do. And that's why you see such efforts going into getting something like first mover advantage in a market. Here's a good example. It's near and dear to my heart. Companies will spend billions of dollars to win a format war. Sony installed Blu-ray capability into the PS3, and it became a more expensive platform, right? It was at least $100 more than the competitor, and they were late to market because there were blue laser diode shortages and all this stuff. It almost cost them the console market, okay? They were late out the gate, and it was more expensive hardware, and they were behind for many years. But what happened was they had that Blu-ray, and that million or 2 million installed base of PS3s started tipping the scales for Blu-ray. And what happened was the PS3 is actually a really awesome Blu-ray player, and it was integrated with a game console that people wanted to have anyway, and that actually ended up tipping the scales. Once Blu-ray won the format war, that actually pulled that more expensive console into the market. And so you have these really interesting dynamics going on because of network effects. Network effects applies basically to anyone who publishes a platform, okay, where other developers or other users are creating value. And so we're always looking at the effects of this. The thing I love about network effects is they have such explanatory power. It explains why we have these format wars and why people are willing to spend so much. It explains why you see markets that are completely subsidized. Why do we get so much free stuff? Well, it's because of network effects. People are trying to capture us as users so that, and this is Adobe is a classic case of this. So Adobe had PDF, and they had authoring tools and viewing tools. And they realized that in order to be able to charge enough money, make money on the authoring tools, they needed to build the base of users. So they gave the viewing tools away for free. They didn't at first, but they learned. It also, network effects explains the relationship between television advertisers and viewers, and to some degree, not completely, because no one can completely explain fanboy behavior, but it does explain why people act a little irrationally and emotionally out on mailing lists about their favorite platform. It is a rational behavior to try to convert people to your platform, because the more people that are on your platform, the more that platform has value. Okay, so go easy on the poor fanboys out there. They're just doing intuitively what they think is in their best interest. So if you look at the intersection between open source and network effects, there's all kinds of network effects in open source. Other developers are writing software for you that you're going to use, and you are writing software for them. And as you see an increase of the number of developers, there's more value for you and them. It creates an ecosystem, and it ends up spawning a whole ecosystem of related services. There's books, training, tools, jobs, and dare I say, conferences, all built around this system that we're building. Now, if you look at network effects in open source, you see that there's not a single community. When I go out on the kernel mailing list, it can actually get a little bit lonely if what I'm talking about is Synopsys USB drivers, right? It turns out that the kernel community is composed of a whole bunch of sub-communities. People who are interested in the scheduler, people who are interested in networking, file systems, all kinds of things. And so you can't just look at the entire bubble and say, well, that's a huge community. Some of the communities are very, very small. And it's also even more complicated than that because people are involved in different communities simultaneously. Someone will, on one day I'll have my USB hat on and I'll be out talking about drivers, and then on another day I'll be talking to someone else about the scheduler. And so we flip back and forth. And one thing we need to recognize about open source is that in order to build this community, we must create generalized software. We can't just create a little thing and just throw it out there. That's not how it works. You've got to engineer it in a way that it fits with the rest of the pieces out there. But generalized software costs more to write. And the dirty secret here is that not only does it cost more to write, it's terrible. Well, it's not terrible. Open source software is good software. Okay, so Jake, don't quote me on that. Anyway, but it does not perform as well as highly customized software, right? Because of these generalities that we add to it, we sacrifice it. It's a little bit bigger and a little bit slower than custom software. So let me talk a little bit about embedded, how that relates to embedded. So an embedded system is something that's dedicated. So we have routers, TVs, digital cameras, set-top boxes. I threw robots on there, although robots are arguably a platform themselves. And no, mobile phones are not embedded software anymore. Mobile phones are platforms. And there's this tension you see between this very specific functionality and the specialization you want to do for that and generalization. Historically, we've moved over the years from kind of custom RTOSes over to Linux. And actually, I could put another arrow on the left of this. It used to be just in-house development. So we've moved to general purpose OSs, and we're moving to general purpose hardware. So the modern SoCs have this incredible complexity. And semiconductor manufacturers, bless their hearts, are just throwing everything on there because they want to, because of network effects, they want to give products that will appeal to the largest number of users. I used to work on Linux Tiny, and we used to worry a lot about the kernel size. The cheapest DRAM you can buy these days is 32 meg, so we don't worry about the kernel size anymore. I heard recently about this chip that you can buy, and this chip cost the same whether it had 9 cores or 3 cores. So they're just throwing silicon at us, and the price of the silicon is getting so low. So if you're in one of these markets, just get used to wasting silicon. It abounds. Okay. My apologies to the semiconductor manufacturers. A couple of years ago, I saw a talk at ELC Europe by this guy by the name of Andrew Murray, and he was talking about boot time reduction. And boot time is something I've done a lot of at Sony. And he made some really interesting comments, and he started talking about how what we do when we're trying to adapt Linux to a particular device, in particular when we're trying to optimize it. So it's one thing to get Linux running, but then you have to meet these requirements for our phone or the cameras that I was doing at Sony at the time. We had a boot time requirement of a second, right? And that's pretty challenging. And so he was talking about a bunch of different things you do to attack that. And I realized that all of the stuff he was describing, not all of it, most of it, was taking stuff out, okay? You have all this software that's been generalized. You've accreted all these features. And in order to get to meet your requirements, you're pulling things out. In particular, one of the examples is kernel module loading, right? So because kernel modules load at runtime on the device, there's a certain amount of cost involved there. And if you get rid of that, if you statically link all your modules, you don't have any link runtime cost at all. And so he's actually removing a feature in order to kind of re-specialize the device. He's taking away that generality. No keynote or discussion would be complete unless we spend a little bit of time talking about device tree. So this is not a rant about device tree. Okay, it's a little bit of a rant about device tree. So there's other reasons why device tree has problems. People are working on it, and bless their hearts. But my chief complaint is that it's hard to specialize. Okay, again, the process of doing embedded Linux, a lot of times when you're in the optimization phase, you're re-specializing. So DT, its very intention is to support single image. Okay, so the kernel is parsing a tree at runtime, and it's making decisions, and so you got all these this gobs and gobs of code that does not get run. Okay, admittedly, so you have a single image that you can run on this CPU and on this CPU and on this CPU, but that means that you have a lot of this dead code lying around. And in particular, you can't do compile time optimizations. And I have a long, sad story about how I was trying to do link time optimization in the kernel, and you can't optimize it anymore. You can't do things like constant propagation. You can't do function coalescing. All this stuff goes away because of device tree. Okay, but, and here's why I have to recant all the negative things I've said about device tree. It turns out that DT builds network effects. Okay, and the way it does this is DT has forced us to go into the kernel and to restructure the code. A lot of code has been lifted out of the architecture directories, and it's now in an area where it's visible to more people. In particular, it exposes the IP blocks between platforms. Okay, so there's a lot of, I don't know if you guys understand this about the hardware market, but there's a lot of IP that's licensed to multiple manufacturers. So you have two different SoCs, and they have the same USB controller on them. And so now that driver is out where it can be shared, and it actually, because that software has been forced into a kind of a more public place, you have more people who can connect on it and develop a better driver and one that has better functionality. So that was my aside about device tree. How does all this relate to the Internet of Things? Well, I think the Internet of Things changes this whole equation. What the Internet of Things is about is ubiquity of computing. We want computers in our cars. We want them in our appliances, furniture, light switches, even in our clothing, maybe in our food. I saw chips that can go in a pill for medical. You put in your body. It's in our infrastructure. They're going to be everywhere. Okay, so we're not putting $50 processors, you know, in all these places. We're not doing smart dust with $50 processors. We want Linux on a 10-cent processor that runs for years on a single charge. What I want is, of course, Linux on a cereal box. I think this would be totally cool. This particular screen grab that I created out of thin air, okay, this is not a real thing. That's a cell processor. I don't know why you'd be wanting to run a cell processor on your cornflakes, but that's neither here nor there. Think about what the cost has to be to achieve that. I have heard from reliable sources that when they put a toy in a cereal box, it costs about a dollar. So can we get a processor and a display and a power source on a cereal box running Linux for a dollar? Okay, and most of you are going, nah, Tim, that's not happening. Okay, well, it's not happening today, but you got to look at the future. So how would we get there? Or do we want to even get there? Do we really need to run Linux in the Internet of Things? Okay, I don't know if you can see it because it's really, really tiny on that finger there, but that's an actually RFID chip, Toshiba RFID chip, that's smaller than you can see with the naked eye. Does it make sense to run Linux there? Linux as it stands today is too big, it's too slow, it's too power hungry. Well, the original Linux system, well, not the original, but one of the first systems, 0.11, ran on a 2-megabyte system, and that could actually do kernel compiles. That was not just like a scheduler and a shell. Obviously, since then, we've built up a ton more features. Do we want to do this? Can we do it? If we try to streamline Linux, one of the examples I want to talk about is kind of a Lego model of software. Is Linux modular enough? So I have a friend who has this really cool Lego crane, and it's got over 2,500 pieces. You can see that a lot of them don't look like kind of the normal Lego pieces. There's a lot of custom pieces on there. It's totally cool, though. It's motorized. It's got this gearbox that allows you to shift between operating the crane and the wheels. And the question is, could we use this kit and could we tear it down to build a little toy car? Well, yeah, we could, but that's not how we'd go about it. We'd go to the store and buy a little tiny kit, right, with 10 pieces. And if we did try to pull down the pieces from this Lego model, we'd end up with a Franken car, right? Because, you know, the gearbox is attached to this other thing, and it's if you've ever disassembled a Lego kit, they kind of stick together in weird ways. Well, it's the same thing with the Linux kernel. It tends to stick together in weird ways because there's a lot of interfaces talking to each other. If I tried to build something that just had the scheduler, say, and the Wi-Fi stack, you know, I end up pulling in ICMP, I end up pulling in the crypto library, and it turns out the crypto library is not that modular, all I want is checksums for my TCP/IP, and I end up getting all this other junk. And I get to boot the O1 scheduler, and, you know, maybe I've only got one process running. So you can't really do this. And it turns out that what I really wanted was this 10-cent little car, right, that was plastic molded. And think about the difference there, about how much it costs to do the setup for a 10-cent car. Okay, it only makes sense to do that if you're going to build a million of these. That's where you can get the economies of scale. And, you know, the price of that 10-piece Lego set is probably a couple bucks because, again, there's more flexibility there. If you remove all that flexibility, you respecialize, you get different dynamics on the pricing. The whole thing about this is it ends up being subtractive engineering. I was shocked to learn when I look back at my career at Sony. I've been at Sony for 11 years now. The amount of time that I have spent subtracting from Linux. I worked on the Linux Tiny project. I did boot time reduction. I had a couple of additive things, like doing tracing, but I spent a lot of time. People would ask me, my parents would ask me, so what do you do at Sony? It's like, well, what did you do that's in that camera? It's like, well, there's like 200K that's free because I ripped some stuff out. So my job is to take Linux out of the cameras. And the problem is that as the system scales up, as Linux gets more and more complicated, bigger, it's harder to remove stuff than it is just to build things from scratch. And you see this really big problem where people don't want to remove stuff, right? Have you ever gone in and gotten config item anxiety? It's like, I don't know, you know, should we turn this config item off? It saves us 5K. It's like, heck no, just leave everything alone. Let's run the same config as everyone else. So basically, you should just say no to subtractive engineering. I don't think that's a way that's going to scale to get Linux into these really, really small devices. And the other big problem, I just spent a whole long time hammering about the importance of network effects. Well, if you slim down Linux too far, if you take out user accounts, you take out some of the system calls, and you take out other attributes, pretty soon you really don't have Linux anymore, right? You have something else, and you're the only one running it. So no one else is helping you debug it. You don't know how it's going to behave. You don't get any of those network effects, which is one of the big reasons we're running Linux in the first place. So it kind of begs the question, what are we striving for? If we're trying to run Linux in the Internet of Things, what are we trying to achieve? Well, usually, if someone's doing a really, really small system and they want to use Linux, it's because there's something in Linux they want. They don't want the whole cake, but they want just a little slice. They want something like the networking stack. They want a file system or USB support. Those are painful to rewrite from scratch. Or one of the really, really big things is they want that SOC support, right? Now, because Linux is so big and so popular, the first OS that a lot of companies develop or support on the hardware is Linux. So that's what you're going to get from your vendor, so that's what you use as your starting point. So what to do? So we've got this, dare I say, paradox. That's the title of the slides. We've got this paradox between the needs or the requirements of this low-end system and this need to keep up the network effects. And I'm going to say, this is the part where you might scratch your heads a little bit, that the solution, the way to keep these network effects in play in the Internet of Things, is to fork the kernel. Okay? So let me talk about that a bit. Because everybody, when you bring up the fork word, they get really concerned about fragmentation. So let me talk about bad fragmentation. Everybody's kind of familiar with the Unix wars, right? And what happened. And what happened was there were about 13 or so of these proprietary Unixes that were all doing very similar functionality. They had different features, but they were overlapped quite a bit. And then what happened is as they each individually went out to try and build up their user bases, they split apart. And so if you notice the circles on the bottom there, each one is just a little bit smaller. Okay? They're about half the size of the combined thing. And what happens is if you do this splitting multiple times, pretty soon you have little tiny communities. And you lose all the network effects. You have a community so tiny that no one is going to write applications for your platform, and Windows is going to swoop in and steal the entire market away from you. That's exactly what happened in the Unix wars. That's bad fragmentation. And we're still living with it. There are several ways that the Unix vendors tried to solve this problem. They created POSIX so they could have consistent APIs across different Unixes. They also did one of my favorite things, AutoTools. Every time you run a configure script, you are a victim of the Unix wars. And, you know, thank you. It solved the problem, but it's, like, painful. But it is possible to have good fragmentation. And this has happened in the history of Linux. If you look at good fragmentation, what you want to do is if you're attacking a little niche market that's off to the side that Linux is not already doing, okay, this is not an overlapped area of technology. And the example I like to use is UC Linux. So the reason that we can run Linux today on a Cortex M3 is because somewhere in the mid-90s, late 90s, a group of developers decided that they were going to take Linux and they were going to run it on non-MMU systems. And they went off and did their own thing. And what happened was they were able to build the network effects in that market to build up and establish something that was bigger. That's the slightly larger yellow circle in that third diagram. The hard part, of course, and the part that's really difficult is when you try to reabsorb. And it took, I was at the company Linio, and we hired people to do this. It took a lot of man years to try and fold that UC Linux support back into the main kernel. But if you look at the final blue circle there, it's bigger. Okay? Linux now addresses an area that it didn't used to address. We didn't fork the community. We forked a little piece of the technology, built it up, and when we combined it back together, we had something that was greater than when we started. We had a bigger community. The same thing, I will assert, is happening with Android. And you can argue about where Android is in this. Android went off for a couple of years, and they basically ignored the Linux community. They just had their head down, and they got their phone out. But we're seeing it being pulled back in. A lot of effort has gone into pulling it back in. A lot of those great ideas that the Android engineers have are now back in the kernel. And we're here at a conference where we have both embedded Linux and Android, and we're all intermingling, and we have a bigger network today. We have more people, all of our you know, kind of core embedded Linux people, Android people. We can all work together because it's come back together. And I'm going to, don't take my word for it, no keynote would be complete without an appeal to authority, so I'm going to quote Linus. And he said, way back in 2000, what made Unix fragmentation so bad was that it was an overlap fragmentation. He recognized this same thing. And people were asking, this was back in 2000, there was a whole bunch of concern about whether Linux would fragment. He said, what's important, or what's good, is if the market fragments. If you can take off a chunk, use Linux to attack an area that it's not currently attacking, well, that doesn't subtract any of the network effects. If you're somehow able to pull it back in, it can add to it. And that's all good and proper. So if we look at the intersection between embedded and open source, how do we attack the Internet of Things? I think that here at the intersection of open source and embedded, we need to establish a new base camp somewhere out away from Linux, okay? And I will leave the details of that to you. Hopefully I've implanted a couple of ideas in your mind. I want you to pay attention to the network effects. Those are really important. How do you fork Linux but still keep those network effects? And I want you to think that forking can equal growth. Together, if we work on it, we have some of the best minds on the planet, and I think we can attack that next 9 billion devices with Linux. So thank you very much for your time.